From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with pasta. Well, a threat to pasta products, anyway. Several years ago, a man and his partner were having a conversation about climate change. It wasn't really a subject the man was too familiar with, so with the help of his partner, did a little research. He read about threats to the environment induced by climate change, including what we could see on a large scale: drought, malnutrition, crop failures, including the destruction of wheat production, which could lead to a global destruction of pasta products. That so-called apostolypse is what led the man, an Italian-American who cares deeply about his culture, to join the climate change movement. Actor and activist Peterson Toscano told this story during an interview with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. He cheekily said that he wishes he weren't so shallow, but that issue is kind of what cracked the door open for him to want to learn more about climate change and push for action. He says with big issues like climate, understanding how they affect people on a personal level is key to creating awareness and motivating would-be activists to advocate for change. Toscano took a year off to study climate change and learn how to approach it in an interdisciplinary way. And now he travels the country doing character work, telling stories, and discussing the intersection of gender, religion, race, and climate. He's in Rochester this week for a residency at St. John Fisher College and RIT, where he'll talk to students and community members about climate change as a human rights issue. And I will just say it again, sort of a high bar for us, but one of the really interesting people we've had the chance to listen to, and now it's great to have a chance to talk to him in person. So, Peterson, welcome. Great to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Well, with that introduction, I feel like I have to be, like, extra good or something. I don't know.
I've heard you before. I feel like it's sort of guaranteed.
Okay, we'll see.
It's great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, your technical title is theatrical performance activist, but you also go by what?
A quirky queer Quaker.
A quirky queer Quaker. Okay, well, whatever you prefer. It's great to have Peterson also with us here from St. John Fisher College, an associate professor in biology and director of the sustainability program. Michael Bowler is back on the program. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
I'm very excited to be here.
And also with us is Harshita Sood, a sustainability initiatives manager at RIT. Harshita, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Michael, when did you first hear about Peterson Toscano?
So 2 years ago, I took some students to the NICSHE conference, the New York State Consortium for Sustainability in Higher Education, and Peterson was the guest speaker there. He did a couple of performances and really did an amazing job of connecting all sorts of different issues in climate change, in sustainability, to things that, you know, maybe we don't always think are connected. And so immediately afterwards, my colleagues and I from RIT and some other people from Rochester said, we really need to get Peterson to come to Rochester and do this for us.
Because talking about your work, it can be a little dry. Relatable is important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like Depression 101 when we talk about sustainability issues sometimes. So having that hopefulness and having the ability to maybe have a little bit of levity is something that maybe we all need a little bit more of.
Okay, so what's happening this week? Harshita and Michael, tell us a little bit about what's happening this week before we dive into his story. What do you want the public to know about what's going on?
Yeah, so this week at Fisher, we've got a couple different things, a couple days worth of events. Peterson was at my class this morning talking with my students about communications and climate change. Tomorrow we're going to be doing some work with several different classes, but then having the performance, the Everything Connected performance for our student body and our small community at our campus center at 6:30. And then after that, we're going to be passing it on off to RIT. Harshita?
Yeah.
We're very excited to have Peterson at RIT this week, and you're presenting in six very different classes, from queering gender and queer looks to principles of environmental health and safety. It's going to be a really exciting week. And as far as public performances go, so we have Peterson performing his Everything is Connected show at our Ingle Auditorium on Thursday evening, and that is open to the public. Anyone is welcome to come. And we are also helping coordinate the Wednesday evening Everything is Connected performance at the First Universalist Church at 7 p.m. And again, free and open to the public. Everyone is welcome. I think we have some really unique events planned with the spirituality and religious life, the Q Center and the Center for Women and Gender at RIT. And one event I'm really excited about is called Building Bridges Over Brunch on Friday, where we have a few panelists coming together to talk about the intersectionality of religion and sexuality and gender in particular. I think there are some real opportunities for healing between different communities at RIT, and I hope that that's a message that we can carry to other places in the future.
All right, so listeners, if you want a chance to see, kind of go back over some of the events, we'll make sure on our various platforms we post information about Peterson's visits this week. It's not just with students. You've got a chance to participate if you like. And your own story. So let's just start. I guess we're going to start on climate change, but then you can peel it back as far as you want. When's the first time you remember really thinking about climate change?
Goodness me. You know, I'm sure it popped up, right? From the 80s, it's been in the news here and there.
These
moments where it's out there more. But it often just rolled right off my back because I either had, I thought, bigger fish to fry, or because of my worldview, it wasn't something that interested me. I was a born-again evangelical Christian for a big chunk of my 20s into my 30s. And the way we looked at the world, global warming was so not a thing to be concerned about. There were bigger issues, and we believed that God would never let the earth be destroyed. So there was that whole thing. And then when I came out gay, I have to say that fighting for our rights was like the big thing. I mean, we had been through a lot of catastrophes in our communities with HIV/AIDS and other things. So I just thought, you know, I've got other things to do. And I heard it, but it's like, this is not my issue.
When you came out as gay, did you also decide, I don't know if this squares with evangelical Christianity in sort of modern era, or did you work through that?
It was many years ago. It's interesting. I came to Rochester for the first time to hear Billy Graham at a crusade many years ago. It must have been in the 80s. And it was this whole world I had. It was my life. So it was complicated because I was told I could not be gay and Christian. So I definitely knew I could no longer be part of the churches I was part of. And I had to not just come out of the closet, but I had to question everything and restart my life in my mid-30s and trying to figure out, who am I? What do I care about? What's important to me? And that's a really challenging. It was a very challenging time.
Now, in this state and even in this city, it's only been recently that we've seen bans for so-called conversion therapy, which I think most of our listeners would be familiar with by now. That's the idea that you can convert the gay out of somebody. And you spent years really trying that, right? And actually spent a lot of money on that.
Yeah, 17 years and over $30,000 on three continents trying not to be gay, involved in conversion therapy. And a lot of it was actually in New York State, because I'm originally from New York State, and I lived in New York City for 10 years. And let me say, New York City is not an easy place to not be gay. I mean, even if you're not gay. And I was like,
don't make me laugh at this.
But see, so there I was like trying not to be gay in New York City, which, you know, and there were these programs in New York City, throughout New York State, that promised that they could make me straight and that it was the way to go. And I spent a lot of time and effort, energy on that.
I want to ask, though, because I know you've talked about this, but I want to make sure I really understand this. Did you really believe that you could do that? And did you really want to, or were you trying to appease somebody else?
Great question. You know, you have to remember, in the 80s, when I was coming of age, they talked about gay men or homosexuals as an existential threat to America. We were the terrorist of the day. The way they talked about gay men back then, it was about, we need to protect the family, that God's going to punish this nation if we, you know, let the gay agenda come through. So there was a lot of panic. Then you had HIV/AIDS added to the mix. And in that toxic soup, it's hard to say if I made a clear decision, but I was panicked. And in that panic, to me, the most logical choice was to not be gay, because I knew the world would treat me better if I were straight. And my church definitely would treat me better. And I wanted to serve in the church as a missionary. So at the time, it seemed logical, but my brain was soaked with fear and shame. And when that's happening in our heads, we don't make good decisions.
Would you have believed it if I told you that you could have a gay president in your lifetime, like an out gay president?
I guess so, because at the time, at least, meaning back then when I was trying.
Sure. Yeah. Right.
Well, no, because part of the narrative was there was this evil agenda that was trying to overtake people of faith and the secular movement. So, of course, it would make sense that there'd be a gay president because, you know, we believed in this nefarious gay agenda that they were trying to convert and recruit people.
Oh, I see. So you might believe there'd be a gay president, you know, on the grounds that there was something evil and nefarious about that.
That's how that whole
movement might spread.
Yeah, that world was set up. And, you know, and again, and the other thing I've been thinking about lately too, like, whenever there was an extreme weather event, it was always blamed on the gays, right? There would be some minister somewhere who would say, well, that tornado that touched down 2 miles away at the Motel 6, there was a party going on with a bunch of gay guys. This is God's punishment. You know, you have this crazy, of course, they said it was the wacky gay lifestyle, but really it was our extreme fossil fuel lifestyle that are causing some of these extreme weather events to become even more extreme.
Well, and we'll get to get there in just a second. You're going to help me book a show for later this week, all right? So that now what we are about to do is what we do all day, every day. We talk about booking shows. And the reason I asked about, do you think you could have a gay president, is I actually don't know in 2019. The first conversation we have about on this program about Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, you know, in so many ways, his polling is rising because he is, and I'm not saying making a political statement endorsing one way or another, I'm just observing, he is remarkably substantive, speaks 7 languages, can speak really fluently on so many different issues. So he's not the gay candidate. He happens to be gay and have a husband. And so I'm thinking, like, the first show we do, do we talk about that and how that, you know, sort of lands in the quote-unquote LGBTQ community, or does that downplay him as a candidate? So help me book this, Peterson. Should we have a conversation with the local LGBTQ community about having maybe the first openly gay president, or is that too diminishing based on identity?
Well, you know, it's a good question. The thing that I think about is often if you're a marginalized person in America, mm-hmm. if you're the first in your field, you have to be so exceptional. You have to speak those 7 languages. You have to be so incredible because you have to prove yourself that much more. The one thing I think is true, it's possible that we would have an openly gay male president before we have a female president in America because of misogyny and sexism. That, you know, if he's masculine presenting, if he's more femme, then he doesn't stand the chance. But if he, like, people are like, he seems like a normal guy.
He's a veteran. He fought in a war.
Yeah. Then it was like, well, you know. Because at the end of the day, it is about gender. And more than anything else. And that's what I learned in conversion therapy. In the end, they didn't really care about who we had sex with. It was very much about, were we real men? Were we presenting in a masculine way? And that's why they did wacky things like taught us how to play football and change the oil in our cars, thinking that this would make us straight, strangely.
They really did that.
Oh, yeah.
Here's how you know, because if you can change a tire on the side of the highway,
that's right.
You're probably straight.
And when I told my dad that, I was already
the handiest guy I know, by the way, is gay. Just pointing this out. I don't know why anybody ever thought that gay people don't change car tires, but okay, go ahead.
I told my dad this. I was an adult already in my 30s at this program in Memphis. My dad's from the Bronx, and I said, "Dad, today in the program they taught us how to change the oil in our cars." And my dad says, "Why would you do that? I just go to Jiffy Lube." I was like, "Dad, that sounds gay. I don't know."
Oh, boy. I've told Peterson, don't make me laugh at some of this stuff, but it's difficult. Okay, so kind of fast-forwarding a little bit here, just give me, and again, we're summarizing big things in short ways here, but what was the moment that you decided, I'm done with this, you know, changing myself, I am who I am?
I, like many people who leave an abusive relationship, there's often these little moments that add up. And there were these little revelations about how this is not working, how it was changing me, but not in the ways I wanted. I was becoming depressed and suicidal. But then there was a moment, literally a moment, I woke up in the morning as if I had woken up out of a coma. And why it didn't happen a week before, a month before, a year before, I don't know. But that's how these things often happen. My brain was clear, as if it had been pickled in a jar somewhere and been restored to me. And my thought was, what am I doing? This is insane. And I just realized that this was a foolish path to be on and a destructive one. And that's the part that people have missed out. And this, fortunately, people are understanding. It's not that it doesn't work. It's not that it's silly. It causes harm, mm-hmm. deep psychological, emotional, and spiritual harm. That's why I'm grateful for cities and states that have bans on conversion therapy.
It was 10 years ago, reading an interview that you did roughly 10 years ago now, that you touched on something that I think is much more discussed now, but still there's still big parts of our society grappling with, which is, what is natural? What is normal? You know, what is normal, quote unquote normal? I'm putting the air quotes that no one can see, but natural. Because so often, you know, you hear people struggle with transgender questions or gender fluidity, the spectrum of gender. And It is sort of minimized by those who don't want to see either rights expand or sort of acceptance happen. It's minimized in a way that says, well, it's only X percent. How could that be natural? And there's lots of things that occur in nature that don't occur with the same statistical frequency as other things, but we sort of struggle with that. Also, just being gay is less common than, quote, being heterosexual, right? But it doesn't mean it's not natural. Why do we struggle with that question of natural, you think?
I'm so glad you bring this up, because this is partly why I think I never got involved with environmental issues, because I was told that what I feel is unnatural. In fact, back in the day, homosexuality was called a sin against nature. So for a lot of LGBTQ people, we're already told we are not part of nature. And many of us who grew up in rural spaces, I grew up in the Catskills, we had to flee those spaces because they were not safe for us. Yeah, you know, save the owl and, you know, save the black bear, but also save that LGBTQ person in nature, because we feel very unsafe often. It's changing somewhat, but that's why cities become hubs, sanctuaries. So I felt very detached from nature because of this sort of language that's going on. And the Bible, too, you know, that's the other area, too. And like, well, this doesn't appear in the Bible, or if it does only in a negative place. And that's why soon after I came out, I used my skills as a Bible scholar to explore who are the gender and sexual minorities in the Bible, who's transgressing and transcending gender. And I did a presentation called Transfigurations, where I look at these gender nonconforming Bible characters, because the reality is, we've always been here in history and nature, but so many stories get hidden. And that's the role of good storytellers, is to make the invisible visible. If it's around gender and sexuality, if it's around climate change and sustainability, it really is about having these things become visible.
My guest is Peterson Toscano, who is a theatrical performance activist and someone who is visiting our area this week for a number of reasons. He's talking to students, doing a lot in the community that our guest will tell you a little bit about again if you missed it later in the hour. Michael Bowler and Harsha Dassault are here from St. John Fisher College and RIT, respectively. I suspect already we're getting a taste of what you've already gotten with your students as to why he's so dynamic and compelling. Already, yes, Michael?
Yeah, this morning we had a nice conversation about how to, connect with people and use short video to make some points and try to reach audiences that we might not otherwise reach. And I got to say, he had my class talking more than I ever have my class talking in one short session. Got a lot of really useful information out of him today. So, you know, his story and his life experiences and his view on how to make these connections is just really it's illuminating for me personally, as well as I think our students.
Harsha, I'm just observing the way he talks about whether it's climate, gender, sexuality. I don't know very many people who can kind of very deftly talk about the intersectionality in a way that is just so accessible. That's not easy to do either, is it?
It's not. In fact, I don't think I've read about or heard about or met anyone else that can do it. So I'm really excited about having you over here, Peterson, this week. And we're going to talk to our students about how do you tell your story, your climate story, your identity story in 90 seconds, 80 to 90 seconds, when that is oftentimes the time span that people have to connect with individuals about a topic like climate change. And as a tech school, I think we do a lot of things very well in communication, storytelling, and focusing on that human aspect of not why climate change matters to the world, but why climate change matters to you is something that we oftentimes don't do quite as well. So I'm excited about having those particular conversations with the non-usual suspects. So not the students that are going to be, you know, at our Student Environmental Action League or Engineers for a Sustainable World, but students who are taking a class about queer theater, students that we don't often see raising their hands when we ask volunteers for a sustainability work day. So that's... it's going to be an exciting week.
Well, and as if you missed it earlier, you know, Peterson was talking about how when it comes to climate change, it can feel sort of remote. You know, it's not really my thing, not really all that interested. I don't really see an impact. Now, to state the obvious, the world is seeing a lot more of the actual physical impacts now. We know that, but there's still plenty of people due to sort of wealth, privilege, circumstance, who can still feel insulated to a degree. So how do you start breaking down the either disinterest or the lack of knowledge about kind of these impacts, whether it's pasta, coffee, or elsewhere? Are you reaching for things that are more tangible?
When I speak to audiences, and they're going to be tired of this throughout the week, it's going to hear me say it over and over again. When we talk about these issues, it's important to lead with identity. Who are we? Because people connect with people they identify with. And then I think it's really important to get people curious about these issues. So many emotions get stirred up, but curiosity is rarely something gets stirred up in climate conversations. It's very common. I'll start a talk by saying, it's strange, I'm not an environmentalist, but I'm really concerned about climate change as an LGBTQ issue, as a human rights issue, as a Black Lives Matter issue, and as an issue that affects our pets. And then I just go on to talk about something else. But of course, there's somebody in the audience that's like, wait, can you stop? Could you explain that? How on earth is climate change an LGBTQ issue? And I love that because they're becoming engaged. They want to know. And as climate communicators, we've got so much we want to share, but it's hard, dry ground. And we have to wait and create situations where people are asking for it and pulling it from us even. And I think that's really important. And I could give you a sample of a monologue I do that always gets people very engaged.
We'd be happy to hear it.
So this is through my character, Tony Bafuzio from the Bronx. It's a scene from my play, Does This Apocalypse Make Me Look Fat? All right, so like with climate change, right? Have you noticed with climate change, there's been this huge uptick in polar bear imagery in the world? These photographers, they're amazing. They take these photographs and they tell whole stories. You see this polar bear? It's on an ice floe. It looks so sad. It looks so forlorn. It tugs at your heart, right? Like you want to go over and hug it, right? No, you don't want to hug it. It will rip you to shreds. They're very dangerous creatures. You know, but it's sad, right? Their habitat's shrinking so they can't go off and murder seals like they like to do. So you know what's happening with the polar bears now? They're going up on land and they're going into people's garbage cans. They're going into landfills. They're disgusting, right? No, they're gross. They become like the raccoons of Alaska. They're horrible. I don't like polar bears. They're dangerous and they're disgusting. But the problem is the climate isn't just warming up in the Arctic. It is, of course. But it's also warming in Central America, where there's this disease, this fungus that's spreading like wildfire, attacking coffee plants. It's called coffee leaf rust. It's a real thing. Look it up. Now, it's going to sound awful, but I think I could live without polar bears. But a world without coffee? No, that is a dystopian future that I can't face. And after I do that monologue, someone comes up to me and is like, okay, so the coffee thing?
On the coffee thing, yeah.
Is that real? But what's so great about that is you can then unpack it and say, yeah, it is real. And in fact, farmers who are growing coffee, it's harder and harder to grow. That's why there's a fair trade movement with coffee, because it's so unfair often. And so they're not making enough money. They're having to leave their farms and move to dangerous cities. And the conditions are very dangerous for their children. And as a result, they want a better life. And they're moving north to our border, which we're in the middle of an immigration crisis and debate about that. So in that cup of coffee, there are so many issues that are connected.
Do you find that people come up to you skeptical about that or really open-minded?
Never skeptical. I never, in all of my work, run into climate skepticism. Never. I never do. Never. And it's because I walk in the room and I assume everyone's on board. I also assume everyone's gay. I just kind of do that because it just makes me more comfortable. But I also assume everyone's on board with climate change, because the problem is so many climate presentations have been reacting to climate denial. Our brains have been hacked. So you'll see a climate presentation, and there's always this one point, and it's that point where they say, look, see, it's real. And I think, well, all that energy that was used and time to prove reality exists, what happens if you don't do that? Mm-hmm. Where does it go? And when I talk about climate change, and when I educate people about it and do workshops about it, I say, when you're telling these stories, truth is more important than fact. And when you can talk about the truth of it, where we are in history, what this means for us, what this means for me, that doesn't get debated, because you're getting to the heart of the matter. And so the only thing I run into that's frustrating are deniers that are the hope deniers. they're the people who've said, oh, we've gone too far. You know, it's out of our control. There's nothing we can do. And then they feel at liberty to do nothing. And like, no, I have no patience for that. That's the biggest skeptics I get, that people think that we can't actually do something to address it.
Do you think of the way our society in a generation or two, but really the last generation, has changed its views on just take same-sex marriage? The way the polling changed and the way it became, you know, sort of more government leaders felt like they were comfortable endorsing it. Did part of that start to happen, and would that have happened more quickly if we stopped trying to, especially the allies, you know, sort of straight allies, stopped trying to say to maybe friends and family, like, no, I mean, like, my friend is gay, but it's okay, as opposed to, well, of course, it's, I mean, as a, the same way that we have to, like, explain, well, climate change is real. Like, don't, here's the, instead of, like, we're moving on here. We it is accepted. This is under, is understood. And we're not going to waste a whole lot more time debating, you know, yes, no.
Yeah, I'm not sure if things would have moved faster or slower, but I knew one thing, that I, when I finally came out and I began speaking about LGBTQ issues, I recognized that if I feel ashamed of myself, people pick up on that. And it's as if I'm giving them permission to treat me shamefully. And so I realized I needed to deal with the internalized shame that I had so that it would make me more effective in my work. And I think there's a certain shame even about climate work, or this negativity around the denial, and even the shame of bringing up an issue that disturbs people so much. And we need to recognize that, no, we're talking about something that's so important and so life-giving in many ways, because we're speaking the truth about where we're at in history, and ultimately that will motivate people to do some pretty extraordinary things.
Listeners, I would love to hear from you about what you think works. Peterson is talking about ways to reach people, not necessarily to break through to skeptics, but just to get people to think about climate impacting their own lives in different ways. I love the coffee bit. I think that's very effective. No one wants to give up coffee. And that does seem like a dystopian future. What works for you, or really what works sort of with those around you, or how do you sort of visualize it or help others visualize it if they're not thinking about it more urgently? You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And are you starting to see climate change as this sort of intersectional issue that Peterson's talking about as well? So in our second half hour, we'll talk more about how he draws those parallels, or at least draws the connections to the LGBTQ community, to race, to all these different ways that the world is impacted, but you might think is sort of siloed. Peterson Toscano is pretty good at getting people to see the connections that we don't always see. So he's here as a guest of RIT and St. John Fisher College. Michael Bowler and Harsha Dassault are here with us. And after our only break of the hour, we'll continue the discussion. We'll get some of your feedback and much more with the remarkable Peterson Toscano next. Coming up in our second hour, the Finger Lakes region has had more than its share of garbage stories. I mean, stories about actual trash. Whether to create a new incinerator project and burn more of it. Whether to bring in New York City's trash. What's happening at these digesters that are supposed to handle one kind of waste, but sometimes, apparently, handle others. Some of the journalists who've done the best work on it are joining us next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just a special programming note. The report by Special Counsel Mueller into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election complete now, and there are still some questions that you might have about some of the details. We've only seen the summary. We haven't seen the full report. And so Frontline and PBS NewsHour are joining forces in a special broadcast tonight, taking a look at what we do know about the Mueller report. It will include a Frontline documentary and a PBS NewsHour panel discussion. It's a 90-minute program, and it starts at 8 o'clock tonight on WXXI-TV. I want to get some of your feedback from our listeners, not just the listeners who are asking, does Peterson need new friends? I want to be his friend. He seems like an amazing person. I feel so bad for you. Everywhere you go, everyone wants to be your friend, Peterson.
A lot of Facebook friends. I'm on Facebook, on the Twitter, at P2Sun. Yeah, YouTube. You can find me all those places. Yeah.
Very easy to find Peterson Toscano. Fred in Rochester on the phone first up. Go ahead, Fred.
Thanks for taking this call. It's like a strange occurrence. I'm a science librarian at the University of Buffalo, and have been working in the area of climate change information and data for over 36 years that begins in Rochester, New York, when the Center for Environmental Information over 30 years ago began publishing the Global Climate Change Digest. It was published, we produced it, it was published by Elsevier Science. And it's really funny that I'm driving to UB right now because I just got done with a meeting in Lima with a group of people about where does climate change fit into the Green New Deal. And what we were discussing was the fact that, we need to have rigorous kinds of education efforts, storytelling to younger children, storytelling to adults to tell our own individual stories about where do we come in terms of our connections to climate issues. And the spectrum of stakeholders that are involved with this particular issue is so broad, mm-hmm. and so broadly defined. And I think that when we see programs like what you're doing, your show right now is doing one of the most critical things that there's. Your guests have ideas that need to be shared so widely because they're reaching out to the hearts of people. And last month, in January, Australia, devastating floods. Devastating floods in Africa. Devastating floods in Nebraska. These are not isolated incidents anymore. These are enhancements from living in a world, a greenhouse gas constrained world. And that's becoming more and more the reality.
So, Fred, let me just jump in and say, on that last point, I want to ask Peterson Toscano. You know, Fred is pointing to the really clear ways that extreme has become more normalized, whether it's extreme drought and wildfires in California or different precipitation events. So often, and again, just listening to the scientists who've been on this program, when we see precipitation events, climate change means there will be more moisture in the atmosphere, heavier rainfalls, heavier snowfalls. So all of these things are extreme. Does that seem to work as much in terms of activating people, or is it the coffee? You know?
Well, it depends who the people are,
yeah,
right?
That's
obviously
fair.
Right. If it's scientists, this is very moving. Some policy folks, but the average person who wants nothing to do with climate change, often it's not going to work often. But what will work is you start talking about pets, because a lot of people have pets, and even if they don't have pets, they have pet stories. So very often the entry point I find is by chatting with people about their pets, and then raising the issue. I'm like, well, you know, pets are affected by climate change and there are things we can do to protect them. Immediately, people are curious because they love their pets. I mean, in America, we'll talk about pets so much more than climate change.
Oh, we like animals way more than people.
Yeah. So if you understand how your pet is affected by climate change, you understand how humans will be affected by it. And I live in rural central Pennsylvania, very conservative part of the world. When I'm home to help my lower back, I go to the YMCA and there's this water walking time with me and a bunch of seniors talking about their church and talking about, you know, their whatever they're interested in. And I just start talking about pets and we have these amazing conversations that crack open to climate change. Because when you evacuate your home, well, where does your pet go? Your pet can't go to a shelter. And almost every American at some point is going to experience some sort of, emergency evacuation. Many have already. Where does your pet go? Do you know where the emergency pet shelters are in the area? Are there emergency pet shelters? That's something a listener right now can Google and see, well, do they need money? Do they need volunteers? Where is that place? So that when this happens, I don't have to worry about my pet being trapped in a house in the middle of this emergency. And I don't have to worry about friends who love their pets so much that they would not leave, that they put their own lives at risk. And there are all sorts of other ways that pets are affected. That's the kind of conversations that, for the average citizen, that opens them up.
I have this vision of you at a YMCA in central Pennsylvania doing the water walking, just kind of talking to people. Or frankly, let's just talk about a whole separate discussion, maybe, is the comfort that men have in locker rooms. You know, the older we get, the more the towels just come off. I don't know what's happening there. It's a lot of comfort.
There is.
And I have this vision of you deciding, I'm still going to talk about climate change no matter the circumstances.
Yeah, I'm a bit mercenary about the whole thing. I kind of take it as a huge challenge. Whatever the circumstance, whatever you're passionate about, I want to help you figure out how that thing you love is already affected by climate change. Because the bottom line is, you don't actually have to become passionate about climate change. you already are passionate about something. There's so much bandwidth
about something
we
that's
have.
Impacted by climate
exactly.
change.
Exactly. Yeah. Or something that because it's your passion, you can contribute. So for instance, if you love camping, right? If you know how to camp and you have camping supplies, you're ready for when the electricity goes out, right? You're prepared for that. And that's a skill that you can teach your neighbors when maybe we have to live for a week without electricity or more. People who do camping, they suddenly have very important life skills to share with their neighbors. So yeah, what do I love is affected by climate change, or what do I love helps me to adapt and build a community and help people in a time of climate change?
And before I get back to our phone calls, one more point that I want to ask you about. In a YouTube video, you mentioned that, you know, early on you sort of toyed with denial and that you kind of did five stages that you went through that happened to, you know, through your performance. They can be all different characters because number one, you've got the freak out, you know, sort of confronting, and then toying with denial. Third is personal purge of greenhouse gases. Four is despair because your individual efforts can't lead to change. And five, engagement and hope. Are you staying with five for now? You feel pretty much like that's where you are?
Yeah, mostly. But I think for me as a climate advocate, sometimes it's helpful to freak out again every now and then, like just to read something really terrifying, because we live in this world where it seems like so many people are living on another planet, like one that's not warming and they're not concerned. It reminds me of what I read about of the HIV/AIDS crisis, where you had a population that was desperately affected and going through crisis. And most of the other people were like, la da 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 da, like nothing's happening. And breaking that collective silence. So I have to freak myself out every now and then.
Moments of panic are actually
moments.
Productive.
Yeah, for
not
me.
Not sustained panic.
No.
But what you're saying really is, though, that the problem is serious enough that we probably should have moments where it's pretty heavy.
Right. But don't sit in those moments. Once you get panicked, then move on to other articles. And, you know, otherwise you'll just become paralyzed.
We've got listeners who are kind of weighing in with more thoughts on what they can do or maybe how they should help. MJ in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, MJ.
Hi, my question is about donating money. I'm helped often by Evan's show at Christmas time when you have the people from all over Rochester mm-hmm. and what they do and where you can put your money to donate. And I feel often lost with the cause of climate change. I do a little bit here, a little bit there, but if Peterson could suggest places, you know, his top places to donate your money, what would they be?
Should I just give my website? No.
Okay.
Well, I think, it comes down to what you're passionate about. So for me, one of the top places I donate money to that I think is about climate change is the Transgender Justice Funding Project, which funds projects for trans people, including homeless shelters and housing initiatives, because trans people on a sunny day have a hard time in America. When it's an extreme weather event and they're living in a rental property that's destroyed, it's that much harder. So if you really care about pets, for instance, see about supporting that pet shelter. Of course, there are many climate organizations. I'm part of Citizens Climate Lobby. It's one that I really advocate for. There's other ones, but you don't have to think of it necessarily as just as going to a climate organization, because in every area of our lives, we need to prepare for climate change. And it could be a way of educating that group too. Say, I'm sending you this money, and I'm particularly sending it to you because of climate change. And if you want to know more about that, please talk to me. And then you could maybe get them on board in helping to amplify that message.
I want to ask Harshad and Michael just about some of the conversations you have with students, because number one, I do think above all issues that we talk about in policy questions, this is the one where they have a bigger moral stake than me or people who are older than them. They get to be on the planet for a farther time into the future than I likely am to be, and they have a big moral stake in this. So I'm curious to know if the conversations with them focus more on individual action or what they want to be done sort of in the big picture. Because right now there's a lot more talk than we've ever seen about whether it's the Green New Deal on the federal level, New York State plans, et cetera. Do students talk more about what I need to do, what my mom should do, what people on the street should do, or what is my government doing?
I would say from my conversations with students at RIT, it's a mix of everything. Mm-hmm. And this is really a personal preference, what the student cares most about. But the way we approach the topic is we've really ramped up our civic engagement opportunities for students over the last couple years. We have a voting booth on campus now during our elections. So I tell students, if there's one thing you could do, make sure that you're civically engaged. So make sure you're voting. And I think it's challenging because every now and then I talk to a student who's like, Peterson, what you mentioned about being a little hopeless. And I tell them, you know, I feel hopeless on a weekly basis sometimes, and I get up and go to work. And I make sure that I'm engaging with other people and just trying to spread that hope a little bit. And there's a variety of ways one can do that. I believe in the power of personal consumer responsibility. So I will carry my water bottle and my mug and my, you know, to go wear forks and spoons and stuff. But I also recognize that by me doing that, that's not solving the larger problem of there are systems in place that need to be addressed to create meaningful change at a larger scale. And that really happens through things like civic engagement. So making sure students are voting, making sure that students are learning about the Sustainable Development Goals by the United Nations. So where we're trying to talk to our students about systems thinking has been changing over the years. So it's a mix of both personal responsibility and systems level change.
Okay, Michael?
Yeah, we were just talking about that this morning in class. And, my students have certainly, like, they need to be awakened to the impacts and how quickly things are happening. And then also about, you know, what things that they can do. But I do feel like as students, they are living in a little bit of limbo where they're not making a lot of those decisions for themselves. They're living at home, maybe influencing the way their parents do things. And I hear students talk about how, well, you know, maybe I can get my mom or dad to do this or that. And then also when they're living at school, like, they're not in charge of how those things are really working either, right? So they're really part of a system. So I think about how they have the opportunity to think to their future and what choices they're going to make when they're actually establishing themselves in their homes and their careers and how they are going to have the opportunity to really make a difference in this world. And that's where I get a lot of hope, too, because I certainly have those hopeless moments. But, that we've got, you know, these youth, these, you know, all the way down to the high schoolers and the middle schoolers and elementary schoolers that are, you know, learning about these things. I've got college kids that really understand that they have an opportunity to make a difference in the world. And that gives me a lot of hope.
Peterson?
Well, and to give a really clear example about this, in most universities, I love working with the sustainability folks because they understand the power of changing systems. So food waste is a big thing in dining halls. So, of course, you can get a lot of people to be more aware of that, educated, eat less food or throw less away. But there was a system change that had happened at campuses all over the country. They stopped supplying trays. By not supplying trays in dining halls, food waste dropped 25% to 30% immediately. Plus, they didn't need to use all of the energy in the water to clean those trays. So one systems change, which of course took a little work to do, affects everyone on that campus, not just for that semester, but until, you know, forever, as long as they have that in place. So that's the power of seeing systems change, because it gets everyone on board, regardless if there's heart is in it or not.
All right, well, let's get back to your phone calls, and this is Tom, next in Brighton. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I'd like to make two points. First, I completely agree. There is global warming. There's no question. We can measure the increase in carbon dioxide in the air. It's a very easy, actually relatively easy thing to measure. I also think generally the temperature is increasing. However, it's a mistake, I think, to attribute a series of hurricanes or increased rainfall to climate change. At this point, I'm not saying that's not the case. I'm saying at this point it's still speculative and not proven.
Yeah, okay. But, Tom, I hear you. So in December of 2014, I had Adam Sobel on this program, who has written a book, which is really one of the books on it. It's called Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate, and the Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. He's a scientist, a professor at Columbia. And one of his points is that, yes, we cannot look at every single weather event and say definitively this is only because of X, Y, or Z. But generally speaking, more precipitation in the atmosphere due to climate change does mean heavier precipitation events, more extreme outcomes, et cetera. I'm not sure why you think that is controversial.
What you said is not necessarily the same as saying that the increased number of hurricanes and rainfall that we've had over the past 20 or even 30 years is due to that. look, we had terrible, lots of rainfall in the early 20th century. Remember the Galveston storm that wiped out a whole city? Another hurricanes of that period. And there was a global cooling of temperatures back in the 17th century, which affected for about almost 100 years, affected England. The Thames River at one point froze, you know. So that's the point I wanted to make. It's still, we could end up undermining the credibility of the danger of climate change if we overstate it for specific kinds of phenomena. That's all I wanted to say about that. The second point I wanted to make was on this thing of, we use the term intersectionality.
Yeah.
We're using that term too much. And it's becoming almost like a journalistic, meme or something. I wouldn't call it a fad, it's too strong a word, but we try to connect different phenomena, political, social, economic, bring them together, and then call it intersectionality. We're overdoing that. That's the other point I wanted to make.
Okay, well, hold on. Stay there for a second here, because I bet you Peterson has some things to say. Go ahead, Peterson.
Well, the thing that I find interesting about climate change is it's a threat multiplier. So it doesn't create conditions, you know, like it doesn't create hurricanes like we never had hurricanes before and now we do because of climate change. No, we've always had hurricanes. We've always had extreme, you know, heat waves, all that. But it's becoming multiplied, right? They're threat multipliers. And that's true not just of weather. It's also true of other conditions. If you're having a hard time getting around a city on a sunny day because of mobility issues, if you're having a hard time breathing on a normal, pleasant day, if you're having difficulty with the police when everything's pleasant outside, if you're having troubles with your housing because of your race, your gender identity, if that's hard when there is just a normal conditions, all those threats get multiplied when there are more extreme situations. And that's, for me, as someone who cares about human rights, that's the thing that actually makes me very curious about climate change, on how it multiplies the existing threats that we have and what we can do as communities to be aware of that. And so that as we're responding to climate change, we have everyone at the table. Because the reality is, yeah, we are all in the same boat together. We're just not all on the same deck. And that's really the key core of this whole, you know, intersectionality, is recognizing that we don't experience the same storm the same way, because we don't experience a nice day the same way in America.
I'm sensitive to Thomas' point about overstating, but at the same time, I want to look ahead to, let's envision a world where, you know, half of Florida is underwater. And I'm not trying to be sort of flip. I'm not even trying to be sensationalistic. I'm trying, at some point in the future, that could happen, and it could happen sooner than we all like.
And maybe you don't like Florida. Maybe this has just been revealed.
There's nothing
on this
about
show.
Florida, man. That's just one example.
Look out for this.
I have family in Florida. I have family in Florida.
It might be a bias.
But the point is, I don't think we're going to look back and say, you know, the real problem here with half of Florida underwater is we sort of overstated some of those rainfall events, you know, a while ago, that only some of them were related to climate. I'm with you that we don't want to overstate everything to the point of meaninglessness, Tom, but I think we're a little guarded against, what science has already told us does happen, which is stronger precipitation events or threat multipliers, Peterson says. So, but I'm here. I hear you, Tom. I mean, like, we'll try to keep our eye on the science and the facts too, and that's important. So, thank you for that phone call. We only have a couple of minutes left here, so why don't I do this? Why don't I turn it over to Harshita and Michael to make sure that you know what's coming up this week? A lot going on with Peterson Toscano this week. What do you want people to know?
Well, starting tomorrow night, as far as public events go, we've got an event, the first event of the week at St. John Fisher College at 6:30. Everything is connected. It is going to be at our campus center. It's open to the public. After that, on Wednesday, we've got our real public event that's in collaboration with Citizens Climate Lobby and the Out Alliance, Fisher and RIT, at the First Universalist Church. And that's going to be at 7:30. And then for RIT.
Just a quick clarification. So the event at Universalist Church is at 7 o'clock and doors open at 6:45. No worries. And then the same show, it's kind of, is happening at RIT as well on Thursday at 6 o'clock at our campus center, Ingle Auditorium. you can search for this online.
Go to my website too, petersontoscano.com. There's links. And the full title of the play is Everything is Connected, An Evening of Stories, Most Weird, Many True. And they will include my own bizarre story of conversion therapy and a scene from my play, Due in Time in the Homo Nomo Halfway House. And there will be a story, a Bible story, about a gender nonconforming Bible character. And somewhat miraculously, I will connect that all to climate change by the last 5 minutes of the play. It'll all magically get connected.
In our last 30 seconds, you introduced yourself as a quirky queer Quaker. What made you a Quaker after all of that?
I am wired for faith in God, and I needed to find a community. So I eventually did find the Quakers, which to me felt like a church for adults. Like, we didn't have a pastor telling us, you know, like, what passages to read. It was a place where I felt I can be truly myself. And so I've been a Quaker since 2001.
What an interesting story. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be here. Peterson Toscano, one more time, your website. People can learn more about you.
PetersonToscano.com, or just look for Queer Climate Change. You'll find me.
Queer Climate Change, Peterson Toscano. I hope you enjoy your stay in Rochester. Thank you. Thanks for taking time to be here.
Thanks for having me.
And our thanks to Harsha Dassault and Michael Bowler from RIT, from St. John Fisher College. They're doing a lot of work this week. They do every week, I mean, to be fair, but especially so here. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Thank you, Harsha.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Nice seeing you. Short break, more connections coming up.